ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 7, Text Number 15. Ataham Amaracharyam Agadha Dishanam Dvijam Prasadha Ishe Nishata Shirshna Tacharanam Sprishan. Sadhayishe nishata Shirshna tachtaranam sprisham. Therefore, aham, I, Amara Acharyam, the spiritual master of the demigods, Agadha Dishanam, whose spiritual knowledge is deep, Dvijam, the perfect Brahmana, Prasada Yishe, I shall please, Nishata, without duplicity, Shirshna, with my head, Tat Charanam, his lotus feet, Sprishan, touching. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation, King Indra said, therefore, with great frankness and without duplicity, I shall now bow my head at the lotus feet of Brihaspati, the spiritual master of the demigods. Because he is in the mode of goodness, he is fully aware of all knowledge and is the best of the brahmanas. Now I shall touch his lotus feet and offer my obeisances unto him to try to satisfy him. Purport, coming to his senses, King Indra realized that he was not a very sincere disciple of his spiritual master, Brihaspati. Therefore, he decided that henceforward he will be Nishata, non-duplicitous. Nishata Shirshna Tachtaranam Sprishan. He decided to touch his head to the feet of his spiritual master. From this example, we should learn this principle enunciated by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Yasta prasadha bhagavat prasado yasya prasadhan nagatigutopi. Quote, by the mercy of the spiritual master, one is benedicted by the mercy of Krishna. Without the grace of the spiritual master, one cannot make any advancement. End of quote. A disciple should never be a hypocrite or be unfaithful to his spiritual master in Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th Canto, Chapter 17, Verse 27. The spiritual master is also called Acharya, Acharyam Mam Vijaniyan, The Supreme Personality of Godhead says that one should respect the spiritual master, accepting him as the Lord himself. Navaman nita karhi chit. One should not disrespect the Acharya at any time. Narmatya bhudyasu yeta. One should never think the Acharya an ordinary person. Familiarity sometimes breeds contempt, but one should be very careful in one's dealings with the Acharya. Agadha dishanam dvijam. The Acharya is a perfect Brahmana and has unlimited intelligence in guiding the activities of his disciple. Therefore, Krishna advises in Bhagavad Gita chapter 4, verse 34, Tadvidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshanti teknyanam jnaninas tatvadharshinaha. Quote, just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master, inquire from him submissively, and render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. End quote. One should fully surrender unto the spiritual master, and with service, sevaya, one should approach him for further spiritual enlightenment. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So this is Indra's concluding statements. It kind of contrasts his statement from yesterday. The statement from yesterday speaks about the impure nature of the impure relationship between a guru and disciple. And this verse speaks about the pure relationship between a guru and his disciple. Understand? Yesterday's verse is impure relationship between a spiritual teacher and his follower. Today's verse is the nature of the pure relationship between the spiritual teacher and his followers. Understand? So yesterday's verse, the nature of the impure relationship between a spiritual teacher and his disciple was discussed. Basically, the spiritual teacher, it was described, the spiritual teacher is basically, he's fool number one. Whatever he speaks is nonsense. He's offering lots of advice, but that advice deviates one from the attainment of the absolute truth. So his instructions were compared to a stone boat, isn't it? The instructions were compared to a stone boat. And that teacher who is following those teachings or having such convictions, then he goes down, isn't it? Similarly, those who place faith in the words of such a so-called spiritual teacher, then he is also loading or getting on the stone boat. So he also goes down, isn't it? This was yesterday's verse in essence. Understand? The instructions of those who don't, is mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Natevidu, Swartakatim, Hivishnu, Darashraye Bahir Arthamanina, Andanya Tanda Rupaniyamanas, Tepitra, what is that? Bada, Urudhamni Bada. This verse is mentioning, Natevidu, Swartakatim, Hivishnu, that the teachers do not understand, the so-called teachers do not understand what is the goal of life, and that the goal of life is the attainment of the absolute truth, Krishna or Vishnu, like that. And what is their, since they are not aware of that absolute reality, what is their action? Durashraye bahir arthamanina. They are absorbed in false shelters. Durashaya. Ashaya actually means hope. Dur means bad hopes. So bad hope means what? There's a hope that the material world is going to work out, isn't it? Just like now, before Krishna consciousness, we had, many of us may have had certain hopes, isn't it? You have hopes before joining Krishna consciousness. Certain hopes in the material world, like hope that your relationships were going to work out. And they didn't. Even though everything was going to hell, hoping against hope that it was going to work. Isn't it? We all have such experiences, isn't it? At least most of us have. Or hoping against hope that I'll be a big success. Usually we have false delusions of grandeur. And we're hoping against hope that one day they will come true. And even after we've come to the spiritual path and we've kind of theoretically rejected that there is no hope in those things, but in our hearts there's great hope that one day it will be there, isn't it? One day I'll find Mr. or Mrs. Right. Within the community of devotees, of course, there will be devotees, but isn't it? This is called Durashaya. So he, that so-called spiritual teacher who is not aware of the actual goal of life, the attainment of the absolute truth, Vishnu or Krishna, then Durasha, they're absorbed. Bahir Arthamanina means they're externally orientated. Bahir means external. They're externally oriented. That means they give the external world a lot of seriousness. They take it very seriously. Whatever is happening in the material world, they take very seriously. Not realizing the ephemeral nature of the material world. Actually, the material world, nothing in the material world should be taken that seriously because it's very temporary. The description in the Bhagavatam is just like the waves of an ocean. You know, the waves of the ocean are constantly coming, yes? The waves of the ocean are constantly coming, isn't it? One wave is a wave of distress, another wave, happiness, another wave, victory, another wave, defeat, another wave, success, another wave, failure. And they're coming one after another, isn't it? Nonstop, isn't it? Prabhupada tells a story of a man who was running to the shoreline. He was at the beach, so he was running to the shoreline. And right when he got to the shoreline, he would stop. Then he would run back. Then again he would do. Like this, many times he was doing. So there was a second party who was observing him doing this. So he got bewildered. What is this fellow doing? So he walked up to the beach and asked him, "What are you doing? Many times I'm seeing you running back and walk. What's going on?" So he said, "I actually want to take a swim in the ocean, but I'm waiting for the waves to stop. And when the waves stop, then I'll take a dive in." So the second party said, "What type of fool are you? The waves will never stop, understand?" So similarly, the waves of duality are constantly accosting the living entity, right? The waves of happiness and distress, heat and cold, success and failure, victory, defeat. They're constantly accosting the living entity. And as conditioned entities, we usually take that very seriously, right? You know, the wave of happiness comes and we become super ecstatic, so-called ecstatic. It's not real ecstasy, but so-called ecstatic, only to be bewildered by the wave of distress that's coming shortly thereafter. And this is why our consciousness is so absorbed in these external affairs that we cannot actually think of the absolute truth. There is no question of meditating on the absolute truth. We're too distracted by material life. Right? Does it make sense? Therefore, one of the regulative principles of devotional service, out of the 64 regulative principles, the first 20 are considered the most important. And in the list of the first 20, one of them is to have this neutrality towards duality. That rhymes, not intentionally. To have this sort of neutrality towards duality. Otherwise, you cannot think of the absolute truth. So the false teacher, he doesn't know the goal of life is the Vishnu Krishna. He's absorbed in external affairs. As a result, Dharashaya, and he's hoping against hope that it's going to work out, which is impossible because it's ephemeral. Andanyatandayarupaniyamanas. And he's like a blind man. He's blinded by his mind, right? He's blinded by his mind that all these things are actually possible. And he leads other blind men into the ditch. Prahlad Maharaj says like this. Understand? He is like a blind man who leads other blind men into the ditch to fall and suffer. Understand? This is the material teacher, so-called spiritual teacher or material teacher. Understand? He is misguiding himself, misguided by his externally orientated consciousness, and he misguides others on the path that deviates from the absolute truth. Understand? And then the so-called disciple, he follows such a teacher. Why he follows such a teacher? Because he is the same position. Dharashaya Bahirata Manina. Understand? He's also externally orientated. He follows such a teacher because they reinforce his own ideas. Right? Oftentimes people, when they go to hear a spiritual teacher, what they accept from the spiritual teacher are things that already resonate with their own way of thinking. And therefore they say, "I like this person." Why do you like that person? Because he resonates with what I think. That means you don't really accept the teacher, you really only accept yourself. And it's only a pretense that you accept the teacher. Right? Generally speaking, when you hear spiritual discussions, you should hear things that don't actually resonate with your own line of thinking. And one reason for that is because we're conditioned. We're actually devoid of wisdom. It means in the initial state, you're devoid of ignorance. Just like just for a simple example, if you were to go to a university class, say chemistry, you're taking chemistry for the first time, you don't expect to hear things that resonate with your own way of thinking in the outset, right? Oh, that makes sense. Actually, you expect to hear things that don't make sense to you, right? And that way, it causes you to think, it causes you to inquire, it causes you to actually learn the subject matter, isn't it? That's what you expect when you go to a teacher, especially in a subject matter that you're unfamiliar with, isn't it? But somehow, though, when it comes to spiritual topics, everyone is perfectly realized, isn't it? This is the mystery of spiritual knowledge. If you ask them, did you understand astrophysics? Oh, no, I don't know anything about that. Do you understand biochemistry? Oh, no, I don't know anything. You don't understand? So many subjects you ask them, they will say no. And you ask them, do you understand God? Oh, sit down, I have many things to say. And then they will go, everyone is a PhD when it comes to spiritual life and God consciousness. And therefore, there's an inability to generally hear spiritual instruction because you already know everything, right? Where's the room for hearing? So therefore, the spiritual teachers that they so-called accept are those that already speak the things that they already believe. And therefore, they don't actually accept such a teacher. They're blind. Also, so here's the language of the Bhagavatam is the blind leading the blind into the ditch. Persons who are actually ignorant of spiritual reality because they have yet to contact persons who are actually experienced that spiritual reality and heard from them submissively to gain that knowledge, right? On account of their own obliviousness to the necessity to do so, right? Does that make sense? Can you follow? Are you understanding? Are you understanding? What don't you understand? Ask a question. What don't you understand? Huh? So first I said you don't understand, then you look, are you understanding? You don't say anything. Then I said, what don't you understand? Question. What is it? Huh? You got the essence. What's the essence? That's one point. We're stuck in duality. What's the other point? The blind leading the blind. What does that mean? Say that again. Did y'all hear that? Where's the microphone? Uh-huh. Anyone who's externally oriented can't lead anyone?
Looking for insight.
Okay. Not bad. Everyone? Try to listen, huh? Try to hear. Don't just space out, okay? So this is going on. This is the relationship between the bogus teacher and the bogus disciple. Bogus teacher speaks all nonsense, and the bogus disciple accepts it because he's also a nonsense. Understand the cheater and the cheated. But both of them are actually cheaters, huh? When one person is a cheater because he speaks nonsense, and the other person wants to be cheated. He wants to hear that you can have both material life and spiritual life together. They want to hear that message. If they hear you have to give up something, no, this is not spiritual. Spiritual means I can have both at the same time and enjoy. And that way, both of them fall down into the ditch. Understand? Free fall. I always say like that. You know, it's like you drop something in like a well, and then you wait for it to drop, but you don't hear anything. It just falls and falls. Yeah, that's the result of such a relationship. So in this verse, the exact opposite is being described by Indra. First of all, what is the position of the teacher? It's mentioned here, agada dishanam dvijam. Understand? Agada dishanam dvijam. Agada dishanam means, Prabhupada's translated here, is his spiritual knowledge is very deep. First point of the spiritual teacher is that his knowledge is very deep. Understand? Bhagavatam says, Shabda Parecha Nishinatam, Brahmani Upama Ashrayam. Shabda Parecha Nishinatam. Shabda means the revealed knowledge of the scripture. So he has expansive knowledge of the scripture. Understand? Scriptural knowledge is like a jungle of sounds. Can you understand? Jungle of sounds. Just like when you go into a jungle, you can easily become bewildered, isn't it? Have you had this experience of going to a forest or jungle and becoming easily bewildered? Anyone has that experience? Only a few people? Only a few people? Any Boy Scouts here or anything? Girl Scouts? Huh? Yes, I often describe I only had a few experiences, but of going into a forest and then wanting to use the bathroom. You don't want anyone to see you, you know, using the bathroom. It's a little embarrassing. So then you try to like mark out where you're going in the forest. Okay, I passed this rock and then that tree and then I went around the corner. And that way you could find your way back. So then you use the bathroom. I had this experience. And I used it. And then when walking back, I said, was it this rock or that rock? Now they look exactly the same. And then you become bewildered and then you get lost in the forest. You deviate from the actual path and become bewildered. You understand this example? Even if you haven't been to a forest, you can understand. So the scriptural knowledge is like a jungle of sounds. It's easy to get bewildered. You read one thing one place and another place it seems to contradict. So the Acharya or spiritual master has expansive knowledge of the Shastra, and he knows how to navigate the jungle of sounds in such a way that you come out with the proper understanding of it. Right, you understand? Just like a forest ranger. Forest ranger knows how to navigate the forest and take you through. So spiritual master is something like that. He has expansive knowledge of the scriptural canon, and he can navigate that very nicely. He has deep spiritual knowledge, in other words. You understand? Understand this word? Aghada Dishanam. Prabhupada, in his explanation of this word in the purport, says the spiritual master has unlimited intelligence. Unlimited intelligence to guide his disciple. Because, why? Why is this the case? Prabhupada is describing here in the purport, the reason that is the case is because the spiritual master is actually a manifestation of the absolute truth. If you want to know the absolute truth, he can only be known by his mercy. Understand? Because he existed before everything else existed. This is the basic definition of God. God is the source of everything. He is that which existed before everything existed. So you can only know, how do you know something that existed before you existed? How can you know it? Just like how many of you know, at least you would say that you know, that Gandhi existed? How many of you think like this? That I know Gandhi existed? Everyone thinks like this? How do you know Gandhi existed? You have seen? You have seen him? How do you know that Gandhi existed then? You heard. Oh, really? That's your only evidence? That's your only evidence? Intense hearing. That's an interesting answer. So, similarly, this is a simple example. There's so many things that we know. Based on what? Simply based on hearing from those we consider to be authorities. So God is such an entity that existed before everything existed. So how do you expect to know that? Unless you hear from authorities, understand? Idea is here, unless you have mercy, how do you expect to understand the absolute? You understand? Very simple logic. Sometimes people say, if God exists, show me God. But how you will see? If Gandhi exists, show me Gandhi. You know, now they will say that's an unfair and unreasonable argument. But similarly, their proclamation for us to show them God immediately is also equally unfair and unreasonable. For several reasons. One reason is to say he existed before everything existed. Another reason is because he's the consciousness. It's a supreme conscious entity. A form composed of consciousness. And we can't even show consciousness inside the bodies before us now. We'll just speak of the supreme conscious entity. Understand? So how you understand the Supreme Consciousness, the Supreme Lord, without His mercy? You would not be able to understand. Understand? You caught that point? You think. Are you paying attention? It is not a very difficult thing I'm speaking. It's very simple. You understand? Where's the microphone? Keep it ready. So unless you get the mercy of God, you cannot understand God. That's a very simple point. There's nothing illogical about that. So then, the Lord's mercy is a spiritual potency. It's called Kripa Shakti. Understand? Lord has mercy. It's a type of spiritual potency. When that spiritual potency takes a form, that is called Guru. Understand? When Krishna's Kripa Shakti takes a form in this world, that is called Guru. Understand? The Guru is called Sri Krishna Shakti Murti. He is a form of Krishna's Kripa Shakti, his mercy potency. Understand? So we say our ability to connect to the absolute truth is by his mercy. So since Guru is the embodiment of that mercy, our ability to connect to the absolute truth is through the Guru. Understand? That Guru is a manifestation of the absolute truth. And therefore he has unlimited intelligence, Aghada Dishanam, to guide his disciple how to do so, how to connect to the absolute truth. Understand? Dvija means he's a Brahmana. Brahmana means a perfect Brahmana. Perfect Brahmana means, one who knows Brahman. Understand? So perfect Brahmana means one who knows Krishna, simply put. So the spiritual master being a manifestation of Krishna, non-different from Krishna, he knows Krishna perfectly. In other words, he loves Krishna. He has prema for Krishna. And because of that, he's able to connect us to Krishna. And how does he connect us to Krishna? Primarily through his shiksha. Understand? Primarily, the connection is made to Krishna through his instruction. Shiksha means his instruction. He speaks something. So yesterday we heard that the speech of the unbona fide guru is like a stone boat, that boat sinks. And the shiksha of the bona fide guru is like a nice boat. what's the opposite of a stone boat? I don't know. A good one. Huh? A wooden boat, okay. It's like a yacht. A yacht, didn't they call it a yacht? Yacht? How do you pronounce that? Yacht. It's like a yacht that can nicely carry you over the other side of the ocean of repeated birth and death, samsara. Understand? His instructions are like the boat. So you have to get on the boat, isn't it? You have to get on, and then you have to stay on the boat. That's the hard part. Sometimes when I don't know how many of us have such experiences, I don't. But on the ocean, apparently there's a thing called seasickness. And the seasickness is so intense that oftentimes people who experience that want to jump into the water to get rid of that experience. So it's so painful, apparently. My spiritual master also mentioned like this. It also happened to him like this. I think Srila Prabhupada also suffered from seasickness. You heard this before? Seasickness is such a thing. So also on the boat of Krishna consciousness, the following the instructions of the guru, you know, and gradually moving over the ocean of samsara, you start to experience seasickness. It means you get sick of this Krishna consciousness. For a moment, it comes up periodically, but for long periods of time. Sometimes that can happen, understand? Maybe you're experiencing right now also, isn't it? Some people are experiencing right now. That happens. And then because of that experience, you want to jump back into the ocean of sensual enjoyment, back into the ocean of Maya, understand? So getting on the boat, that means accepting the instruction of the Guru is the beginning, but staying on the boat, continuing to accept, continuing to follow, surrender, and so on, that is much more difficult. But if you're able to do so, then that merciful manifestation of God in the form of Guru, in the form of the instructions of the Guru, can carry us over the other side of samsara. So this is the difference between the bona fide Guru and the bogus Guru, we heard previous verse. Understand? Bona fide Guru is a manifestation of the Absolute Truth. Manifestation of the mercy potency of the Absolute Truth. His instructions can carry us over the ocean of material existence. He is said to have unlimited intelligence to guide his disciple. That means that because he is so connected with the Absolute Truth, for which he is said to be non-different from him, he has the inspiration that is coming in his heart in terms of our welfare is coming directly from the Absolute Truth. Understand? A faithful disciple will think in this way, that whatever my spiritual teacher is speaking is the inspiration of God coming through him. Understand? He will think in this way. He sees that the delegation of Krishna is coming through his guru. Otherwise, if you think the guru is just an ordinary soul, then you can take it or leave it, isn't it? He's just a jiva. He can take it or leave it. But if he's bona fide, you can only take it and no leaving. Understand? Understand? So that's the bona fide guru. And who is the bona fide disciple? That is the second line. Prasada yishe nishata. He renders service to the guru. And that service is qualified by saying nishata. He renders service to the guru without duplicity. Understand? Very hard thing to do. Render service to the guru without duplicity. Understand? What is duplicity? Duplicity means you show one thing with having another intention in heart. Understand? Showing one thing but having another intention in the heart. So one can render service to the guru with duplicity. Render service to the guru with duplicity means what? One wants to be recognized for his service. One wants to gain prestige from his rendering service to the guru. Understand? This is called duplicitous seva. You don't serve the guru for the guru's sake. You serve the guru because you need honor. You need recognition. Like this, for that reason you're serving guru. And that's simple. There's no simplicity in that. You're wanting something out of it other than Krishna consciousness. Understand? You want something out of that relationship other than Krishna consciousness. And when you don't get it, you become disturbed. Duplicity is said to be the lover of pratishta. Understand? Just like, what is it meant by this? This I mentioned before, I was looking it up today. You understand? Duplicity is a lover of pratishta. Pratishta means false prestige or the desire for recognition. Why is that like this? So this example is given by Lord Chaitanya, that a person who is maintaining a lover, he would do all his duties very nicely. So that the husband does not suspect anything, right? Like, let's say if a woman was keeping a lover, she will perform all her household duties very nicely, so the husband does not suspect anything. But all her inspiration is coming from meeting with her lover, isn't it? Although she is showing nicely her duties, but all her inspiration is coming from meeting with her lover later on, isn't it? Maybe some of you also have such experiences. I can bet some of you have, at least. I can, by glancing in the room, I can understand. Some have such similar experiences. Externally, you're showing one thing to your spouse, but all your inspiration is coming from another lover, isn't it? This is called, so similarly, duplicity. In duplicity, you show that you're doing everything very nicely. Understand? You're rendering service very nicely. You're preaching to materialists very nicely. You're following the rules and regulations of Christian consciousness very nicely. You're putting on a nice show, all these things. You're preaching to the objects of sex desire very nicely. For example, actually there's a long list of them given in the Manashiksha by Raghunath Das Goswami. I can't remember all of them. So you show all these things very nicely, but all your inspiration is coming from the desire for recognition. Understand? The desire for being number one. So therefore, it said that duplicity is a lover of pratishta. Understand? Very hard to give up. This duplicity is very difficult, challenging, very big challenge. Even you may give up lust, anger, greed, pride, envy. Those things you may give up, but to give up this duplicity is hard. Harder than that. It's considered harder than that by Raghunath Das Goswami because of pratishta. So abandoning pratishta, becoming simple, rendering service just for the pleasure of Guru, Indra is saying here, Shirshna touch taranam sprishan. I will touch my head to his feet. I will now take full shelter of the Guru without duplicity, and that way I can achieve the goal of my life. Prabhupada comments here in the purport, this is the secret to spiritual success. By pleasing the spiritual master without duplicity, you can attain Krishna. And if you are not able to please the spiritual master without duplicity, then you can never attain Krishna. There is to receive initiation from the spiritual master, according to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, is simply the expression to the guru of the absolute necessity for a spiritual teacher, and that I have really accepted a bona fide teacher. Understand? Two things. What does it mean to take diksha? It is an expression to one's spiritual master that I have understood that in order to attain the absolute truth, I absolutely require a spiritual master. It's not that I can take it or leave it. That's what the process of diksha is about in terms of consciousness, according to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. Understand? First point. What's the first point? Michael. His first point. What was it, Michael? You're not Michael. Michael.
So the first point.
Huh?
I don't remember the first point.
You don't remember? I just said it 3 seconds ago, huh?
I wasn't focused on. I know the second point though.
What's the second point?
You realize that you must take diksha. You gotta realize there's no other way to get the absolute truth except from the authority of the spiritual master.
Okay, that was the first point.
That was the first point.
Good, everyone. You're getting better. You were hearing the class. And what is the second point? That I've actually accepted a bona fide guru. Right? That's what initiation is supposed to be about. This is called without duplicity. That I absolutely require bona fide guru, and that you are such a bona fide guru that I'm taking shelter of. And that way, Tavidi Pranipatina Paripashina Sevya, these things go on. Then you can attain Krishna, otherwise you cannot. So Indra decided that he will do that now. He was not a very sincere disciple. He was disciple in name only. He was rendering service because of duplicity. There was no simplicity in his actions, his character. Now giving up his duplicity, he wants to take shelter of his guru, but his guru has unlimited intelligence to guide him. So then the guru doesn't disappear from his vision. So he'll be chastised. He got that inspiration from Krishna. So then the pastime will continue on in this way. Are there any questions, comments? Okay, 1, 2, 3.
Very much for your enlightening class. This point you mentioned, I had questions from the beginning of the class, but I think this last point really caught my attention. It kind of reminds me, you asked Nivina Nirdavu a similar question. The basic point is this, is many of us, or at least myself, in the beginning, we are very duplicitous in our practices of devotional service. We're inspired by so many other things besides genuine desires for service. So then at some point, by Krishna's mercy, you will recognize that because I was inspired by so many other things that are not being met, now I feel discouraged in my spiritual life. So then we begin what we call this balancing act. Okay, I have certain conditioned needs, but I'm also trying to be sincere. So to some extent, I'll feed my conditioned nature so I can continue to be sincere. And I would like to know from you, what does somebody who's doing that responsibly and progressively look like? So he doesn't become too absorbed in his conditioned needs, but at the same time he recognizes, yes, I have this conditioned nature and it requires this much.
Well, it depends on A, what you're defining as a conditioned need. That's the area that's so unclear, really, especially nowadays. What is a need, really, and what is just a want? Because we have conditioned needs and we have conditioned wants also. And we usually tend to conflate the two, actually. You know this word conflate? Conflate means like merge them together and make it one idea. All right, so there's conditioned needs and there's conditioned wants. And we usually tend to merge the two. So all our wants become needs, right? I need a Ferrari, for example. It's just a want, it may not be a need. The Toyota Corolla from 1985 you're driving will do just fine and still running. So you tend to conflate the two ideas. So that's the part that's really hard, is that what is a need and what is simply a want. And as far as spiritual development is concerned, surrender is the doorway to the realm of actual devotion to Krishna. So we go through what we call a balancing act, but the balancing act maybe in terms of like our activities, like what we need to be actually doing in order to make, because we can't, for example, let's say, surrender to just chanting 24 hours a day and hearing about Krishna 24 hours a day. So we have to balance our activities. I need to do this. Also, I have this need. I have, you know, a particular perhaps need for some emotional support, an emotional partner. Those are sort of conditioned needs that I can see recognized. But to say that, for example, in terms of what I was discussing in class, I need to be recognized, that is not a need, that's just a want. And so we may recognize in the course of our development that that's what I was after in the meeting, and that's what was inspiring me or nourishing me. And then after recognizing that, one has to let it go. And I'm sure the process of letting go is not an easy one. But that's not exactly a need as such, for example. We require, of course, attention in terms of learning the philosophy. Someone has to be attentively answering our questions and so on, attentively teaching us the philosophy and so on. But that, you know, aside from those sorts of elements, it becomes unclear what is actually a need and what actually just needs to be let go of completely for the actual development. Otherwise, in the name of balancing act, we're just maintaining anarthas and not making any advancement whatsoever. So I don't know if you'll find the answers to your question until you really clarify what is needed. What is needed in Krishna consciousness is spiritual instruction, which we have plenty of, probably more than we can handle, actually. And that's actually really all that's needed. From the guru's business is basically the communication of transcendental knowledge. And then aside from that, other things are just extra icing on the cake, but it's not exactly his duty per se. Like, it's not the duty of the guru to get people married, for example. That's not his duty. A guru may, out of his kindness, do that, but that's not the duty of a guru, to get people married, for example. And then so if one goes into it expecting that from the guru, then he's going to be disappointed. Similarly, it's not the duty of the guru to be someone's mom and dad. That's not his duty is to speak the absolute truth, spiritual knowledge, give us spiritual instruction for our progress. And after he's done that, he's performed his duty. And then it's our responsibility to follow that, which is very challenging, actually. So then you may require further instruction in order to follow that. That's fine. So you ask about the further instruction, how to follow it, but then you have to follow it. It's not that we continue to exhibit weakness of heart every time it's time to follow. You know, I need more. How much do you need? You already got 24 hours straight of, you know. I remember one friend of mine, He's always asked every devotee, every senior devotee, for mercy and instruction. And particularly our spiritual master, he was always asking, please give me instruction. So Guru gave him several instructions on several different occasions. And then we were talking the phone one time. He said, Prabhu, I want to fly to so-and-so. I want to see Guru Maharaj so I can get some instruction. I said, Prabhu, you're not even following the instructions you already got. There's so many instructions you already not following. Why don't you just try to follow those first? You keep getting more instructions and not... And so in that way, the confusion comes in identifying what is really a need. It should be known from the outset that spiritual life is not for the faint-hearted. And the perfect image of that is Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. That's the perfect image of it, because he's going to have to surrender to Krishna. And the thing that he has to do in order to express his surrender is very difficult. So that image is itself, tells us or expresses to us the reality of spiritual life. Spiritual life is ego death, ego effacing process. So anything that is ego-effacing is very difficult to digest, right? You understand this word, ego-effacing? Effacing means like to erase, right? So the spiritual process is going to basically kill your ego. And that whole process is not a very joyful one. Therefore, the whole idea that, you know, here's, you know, we were joking about this. Here's a book that are free from stress. It's like, not it. Exactly. So Dharacharya initially said, it'll free you from material distress. I was like, not exactly. In fact, some devotees experience it might bring material distress in certain instances. So any process, any genuine spiritual process, whether it be Krishna consciousness or the yoga mark or even Gan, they're all processes that involve ego death. And so that experience will be painful no matter which way you put it. Although it's susukam kartumavyayam, it's susukam, it's easy to perform because the actions of bhakti are very easy. But the experiencing of the ego death is not an easy one. And so I guess the essence of my answer is that A, identifying what is in need is very challenging. And B, expect a rough ride because ego death is not going to be an easy thing to go through. It's something we all have to go through and it's going to be a challenge. Therefore, we need the association of devotees to help us through it and so on. I don't know if that satisfies, but that's the essence of what I count for right now. Okay, Justin Prabhu.
Thank you for your words of wisdom. I think I've asked you this question before, mm-hmm. but I'll ask it again. So when we're born and raised by our mom and dad, we take them as the absolute authority on things.
Sure.
And then we go through, you know, a rebellious period when we realize, you know, they're not the absolute.
Sure.
They don't know everything.
Sure.
And then we might believe a teacher at school, and then
sure.
we might realize they're not the absolute authority. So there comes the need for a process of determining who is, you know, a legitimate guru from a not legitimate guru, but we have imperfect senses.
And
so,
we're in ignorance.
And we're in ignorance.
Yeah,
so how does one differentiate between
difficult.
A stone boat and a wooden boat with imperfect senses?
Problem, huh? Problem. Big problem. Just like when you go to school, how do you know who is a bona fide teacher and not a bona fide teacher? How do you know? If your starting point is ignorance, how do you know? If you don't, ignorance, so for chemistry, same example I use in class. If you don't know chemistry, how do you know who is a chemistry teacher and who is not? Or even if someone knows something about chemistry, how do you know he can teach it and who can't teach it? If your starting point is ignorance, you don't know. Just like sometimes agnostics, you meet certain persons who identify themselves as agnostics, and they say, it's not that I don't reject God, I just don't know if there's a God. And nobody knows. They kind of, agnostics are like this, but some agnostics say like this, that I don't know and no one knows. But if you don't know, even if someone did know, how would you know it anyway? You understand? Your position is one of ignorance. So if we're in ignorance, how do you decide? How do you know? This is called epistemology. How do you know, actually, when it comes to accepting authorities? Very difficult, isn't it? Very difficult. Finished. Practically hopeless, actually, isn't it? Hopeless, huh? Helpless, huh? Say it. Hopeless and helpless. Understand? This is our position. That's the first thing you have to understand in spiritual life. It should engender a sense of humility that my position is hopeless and helpless. You walk into a room of 1,000 people, all of them claiming to be bona fide teachers, and most of them are not, let's say. Then how you will find who is the right one and who is not if you don't know anything? Hopeless? Helpless, isn't it? So then there's a couple of factors that goes into this, and like a more of a metaphysical factor and maybe more of a practical factor. The metaphysical factor being that faith is a starting point for anything, for receiving any form of knowledge. All forms of knowledge, material or spiritual, are preceded by and proceed on faith. Take the chemistry example, take Krishna consciousness. Both are preceded by and proceed on faith, right? Luckily when it, yes, they proceed, isn't it? So then, luckily with Krishna consciousness, as we tend to express it as a scientific process, and that there's something to do and you can experience something, you can do the experiment and get an experience. So then, one conducts the experiment of Krishna consciousness, and then by gradual experience, your faith is fortified and elevated, right? First you need the knowledge so you know what you're doing. That's one problem, most people don't know what they're doing. They join Krishna consciousness and they don't know what they're doing. Then they say, I have weak faith. But if you don't know what you're doing, then how, of course your faith is weak, isn't it? Isn't it? If you don't know what you're doing, of course your faith is weak. So first you need knowledge. Know what you're doing. So this, it's similar, you're in a class. They have to give you the knowledge of what you're doing first, so you know theoretically what's going on. And then based on your knowledge, you conduct the experiment, right? And then you get results. So then, understanding that all processes precede and proceed by faith, you faithfully hear from persons, somehow their teaching has resonated with you for whatever reasons. They've resonated with you. Well, I to take that as the exclusive factor is certainly wrong. But like I said, that the bona fide teacher will often speak things which will not resonate with exactly our own way of thinking, but will force us to think about our way of thinking. And then he'll defeat us. That's the nice thing about spiritually, more spiritually advanced persons. We have our own way of thinking, and then they kind of either broaden our vision of it. Maybe our vision was something, has some element of truth in it, in a seed form. They broaden our vision of that understanding, or they just completely smash it. And so what happens when you speak with a learned, elevated spiritual personality is that they tend to speak things that will shake your world up a little bit in terms of thought, your world of thought up, and it will force you to think about your own stances on things. And that way, they remove doubts, and they draw you in closer to them, right? So you have doubts, they answer your doubts, or they defeat you, and by doing that, they draw your faith toward them, and ultimately towards Krishna in our context. Does it make sense? And so in that way, okay, now you've drawn my faith towards you. Now I'm ready to offer myself in shelter. And then they give you the knowledge by which you can conduct the experiment of Krishna consciousness. And then by experience, your faith is fortified and it's elevated. And you continue to proceed in this way. So in that way, our starting point is one of helplessness and hopelessness. But we often mention, Prabhupada has mentioned this also, to the degree that we're actually sincere for that connection can be had. And then from there, you have to go through this process of putting forward the doubts. You know, don't let the doubts stay there. You have some, no matter how spectacular the doubt may be, like you may have a doubt that, I don't know if I believe if Krishna has a form, if God can have a form. Now, in a society of devotees, that's like almost like a blasphemy, you know. If you raise your hand, I don't know if God has a form, you know, you can envision all the devotees like looking at you. You know, you heretic, or, you know, sometimes we feel scared to put forward those types of questions. No, put forward the doubts. This is a sign of intelligence. This is a sign of intelligence. You have doubts. Then the doubts are removed. Your faith is drawn in. With the deepening faith, you conduct the experiment. You make progress in your experience. And this way, you grow in Krishna consciousness. Of course. And I don't think anyone actually does that. They don't actually do. Even for persons who so-called blindly believe, they don't blindly believe what the guru says. They blindly believe what they say. And they say, my guru has said. But you already thought like that before your guru has said. And therefore you accepted it. Generally, no one blindly believes in guru. Any thoughtful person will not blindly believe in anything. Nor has Prabhupada encouraged that. Spiritual life is supposed to be meant for the most intelligent people. Intelligent means thoughtful about things. They hear things, they don't make sense, they ask questions, they try to gain. And that's the beginning. Therefore, Krishna refers to it as Buddha Yoga in the beginning. You know, like connection with the absolute through one's intelligence. Intelligence, it is not that you can be intelligent when you're outside, but when you come inside, leave your intelligence at the door, come inside. And then you sit in the class and you have a bunch of dullards and no one can understand anything. That is not required. There's always stuff. Okay, Shravan, then you can go and you can go. We have to end.
Thank you.
You're mentioning that our inability to hear the lecture.
Okay.
So we see how to improve in that direction.
Oh, it's very difficult. and how to improve in hearing is a very challenging thing. One thing is faith. You need faith in the speaker, right? Otherwise, it's hard to hear. Understand? Without faith, you cannot hear very good. You'll be argumentative. Understand? Another thing is, actually, you require knowledge to hear more effectively. You understand? Knowledge is required to hear more effectively. Just like when you come into the class without any knowledge of the subject matter, you don't hear so much. You can't. But when you come into the class with understanding of the subject matter to some degree, you can hear a lot more. Just like Dhiraj Prabhu, I gave him this assignment of reading the Nectar of Instruction in 1 week. Did you do that? Not in 1 week. It took some time because of the festivals and so on. So anyway, after reading the Nectar of Instruction, he came to the Bhagavatam classes. And he was hearing so much more. He said, oh, this is what it says in Nectar Instruction. And he was able to make the connection. So knowledge is also required to hear more effectively. So oftentimes because devotees lack a lot of understanding of things, knowledge, they can't hear so effectively also. So faith is a problem. Knowledge is a problem. Another problem is just the contaminations in the heart. Anartas make it hard to hear. You know, of course, how to get rid of anartas, then you have to hear. This is a great difficulty. The main obstacles that I've observed on a very practical level from devotees is faith is a problem for most devotees, especially in the Brahmacharya ashram where there's so many speakers. Another problem is staying awake, in terms of just practicality, just being awake for the class. Oftentimes we're looking for the inspiring discussion, you know, the funny discussion, the storytelling. We're looking for that. So if a speaker just comes and just sticks straight to the point and is a little bit, how do you say, monotonous and sound and terse, then you don't find, that wasn't inspiring, so you couldn't hear anything. These are some of the practical obstacles I've observed on the personal level and from devotees in general. So faith is required, knowledge is required, a desire for education is required, right? Not just a desire for being inspired by the class. If you just look for inspiration, you might get inspiration. But inspiration doesn't long hold without proper education. You have to know what the subject matter is about. Just like yesterday, I asked a few devotees after the class, I said, what was the verse about? I didn't ask them what points they got out of the class. Because you ask them what points, they'll tell some 2-3 sporadic points that have nothing to do with the discussion. I asked them, what was the actual verse about in yesterday's class? No one can say. So a desire for education, like I really want to know what the actual subject matter is talking about. These are some things that help. Faith like that. Okay.
As we see myself, the inquisitive to the hear, when I came to Chicago, in the beginning was to stop a little. And gradually, after 1-2 months, falling down. How one can work towards to keep in study more? What are the aspects?
Keeping what? Steady enthusiasm?
Enthusiasm.
That happens to everyone. That's not surprising whatsoever. The same points apply. Same points apply now as before. Faith, enthusiasm, desire for education. Same points. We should also understand that enthusiasm is based on intelligence. At least as Prabhupada has defined it in the Nectar of Instruction. How does Prabhupada define enthusiasm in Nectar of Instruction? Anyone recalls? Someone can say, I don't remember. Give the microphone to someone. Enthusiasm that Prabhupada gives in Nectar of Instruction. activity executed with intelligence is called enthusiasm. Understand? So activity like hearing a class or participating in the kirtan. So activity executed with intelligence. So usually we think of enthusiasm as something that like enters inside of us and gets us going, you know? That's usually how we think of enthusiasm. We don't think of it as like an intelligent application. It's something that comes from up above and kind of like possesses us and like, wow, all of a sudden I feel enthusiastic. That's not, Prabhupada says, excellence executed with intelligence. So you may not be enthusiastic to take medicine when you're sick, but if you're intelligent, you take it anyway, right? So enthusiasm seems to be based more on an application of one's intelligence. At least that's Prabhupada's defined it there. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur defines it in terms of faith, than just like something that kind of possesses us and so on. So the same points I mentioned for your first question would apply here as well. Intelligence is required. Okay, you can go. You can, and then we have to end, actually. It's already past 8:30.
As a follow-up, Hare Krishna, sorry. As a follow-up from Yamanchuru's question, I was wondering, his point that real renunciation is engagement according to suitability. So we all have unique material situations that correspond to particular activities that we're suited for in this particular body. Could we say it's the duty also of the guru, the shiksha, specifically like a shiksha guru, also maybe peers who are helping somewhat, helping other peers, helping us understand what would be our appropriate engagement that would be most like facilitating for real renunciation. But that also could be a duty of the gurus and the peers to help specifically give some direction in terms of what activity will be most suitable for my current material situation as I'm moving forward in my spiritual life also.
Yeah, and that it may be assisting one's bhajan that can be applicable. But it won't be his duty to find you a wife. So he may say for your type of psychophysical situation, it might be good if you had an emotional partner to help you process.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, now Guru Maharaj, you're going to find them for me? You know, he may or may not do that,
yeah,
but
course,
that's not
course,
his duty.
Of course, right. I was just thinking the example of Krishna and Arjuna. You know, Krishna told Arjuna to fight in a war, and that was what was favorable for his spiritual progress.
Of course, we have to understand that Arjuna's fighting in the war was not because it was favorable for his situation. It was he fought in the war because it pleased Krishna.
No, it was his svabhava as a kshatriya.
No, Krishna gives that message in the Bhagavad Gita. That's a message. You have to act according to Adhikara. That's not Krishna's point, though. His point is that I want you to do it. And Arjuna's decision to do so was based on, as he says, Karishe Vachanam Tava, I'll do it as you want me to. If mid-war Krishna says stop fighting, he would have stopped. So Sarva Dharma Prit Yagya Mami Kamsharanam Raja. That's the actual conclusion. That was the actual inspiring factor for Arjuna's action. The message of acting according to Swabhava is also a message that Krishna does discuss. And it's not an unimportant one also. It's not without its place in Krishna consciousness also. But it wasn't the source of his inspiration. In terms of that example, his inspiration is Krishna wants me to fight in the war. So he did it. Okay, final thing, y'all. Okay. All right, then. Thank you all very much for tolerating me. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Brahmachari meeting downstairs in the usual location. Hare Krishna.